This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
It's Thursday, December 13th. After more than a week of climate change talks, China is still expressing disappointment with the world's rich countries for shirking their responsibility to help poorer nations adapt to climate change. Currently, in an act of protest, China plans to build 100 coal-fired power plants a day, sell 2 million cars a year, and pollute all its drinking water. That'll teach him. This is The Current Podcast.
Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. You're listening to The Current. On the social networking site Facebook, there are photo galleries of 16-year-old Axa Parvez. In one picture, she wears a long purple dress over her leggings. In another, a form-fitting blue t-shirt. Axa lets her bangs hang over her face. She pouts her lips. She puts a hand on her hip. And in every picture, whether she's in a baggy red hoodie or a tightly cropped jacket, Axa wears large hoop earrings. Now, I don't know much about Axa, but it's clear she liked fashion, and she wasn't afraid to strike a pose in front of a camera, and I imagine she must have loved those hoop earrings. In the flood of outrage since Axa's death, the question about community and the descriptions of a clash of cultures, we still only know so much about the murdered Mississauga teen. Police say a man called 911 at 7:55 a.m. on Monday morning to say he had killed his daughter. Axa Parvez died that night at Sick Kids Hospital in Toronto. Her father is charged with second-degree murder. Her brother faces obstruction of justice charges. As we look to what we know about the life and death of Axa Parvez, what we know about her friends, the school system, and her family's cultural convictions, we'll return to one simple question. What, if anything, could have been done to prevent such a tragedy? Well, let's start with what we know. Axa Parvez was a grade 11 student at Applewood Heights Secondary School in Mississauga. According to her friends, she had a 5 p.m. curfew, and her parents forced her to wear a hijab to school. Axa Parvez was the youngest of 8 children, and up until last year, an older sister would tell her father if Axa misbehaved at school. But that sister graduated last year, and this past September, friends say Axa started taking off her hijab on the bus on the way to school. She'd put it back on when she was on her way home. Her friend said every time she let her hair down, Axa felt liberated. Here are two of Axa Parvez's close friends, Dominique Holmes-Thompson and Ashley Garbutt, describing the dual life Axa led.
She wanted to show who she really was. She wanted to show her own, like, her own beauty. But he wanted her as, like, their culture, wanted her to wear Pakistani clothing, wearing the hijab and everything. She didn't want to do that.
She'd leave the house wearing her hijab and then change.
And then when she'll get on the bus, then she'll take off her hijab and then she'll come to the bathroom and change into tight pants.
Well, this fall, Axa spent some time at a shelter. Her friends say she was abused at home and was hit on the arms and face. According to reports, Axa returned home after receiving a letter from her family promising she would no longer be forced to wear the hijab. Then a little over more than 2 weeks ago, she left home again and began staying at a friend's house. Although Axa was staying with a friend, on Monday morning, her brother, Waqaz Parvez, picked her up at a bus stop where she was waiting to go to school. He told his sister that she should come home to get a change of clothes. On Tuesday, Axa's friends huddled outside their school. They cried and embraced. The school set up a book of condolences on a velvet-covered table. Grief counselors were called in. The Current met up with 4 of Axa Parvez's schoolmates right after they learned that she had died in hospital. You're going to hear the voices of Scott Irvin, Cody Vatrez, Katie Dunks, and Jeremy Horvatin, who were at the Square One Shopping Center in Mississauga.
Axa played a pretty important part in the personality of, like, my class. We always sat near each other because we'd all joke around or whatever. She always seemed like a happy person. Never seemed like anything would be bothering her at home, although she never really talked about her home life at all, so I never really had any reason to be suspicious about it. In grade 9, she wore the traditional clothing of, like, her background, and then we all came back for grade 11. She had changed to, like, dressing more street, I guess I could say.
Maybe she was just scared, and maybe she didn't think that she could go and talk to people about it. And other kids don't have that. There's other kids who go home to a happy family, who sit down every day and have dinner together, and then there's others that go home and sit in their rooms and are isolated from everybody else in the world.
I'd say it's up to the schools, because guidance counselors now are more there to more or less direct our futures in education and less our personal lives, but they should have that aspect, and maybe if they would, then this could have been prevented.
When I heard that she had actually passed, I was devastated. I couldn't think properly for a couple minutes. I was just sitting there. I still feel terrible because, like, it's a reality.
Well, those are the voices of four of Axa Parvez's classmates at Applewood Heights Secondary School in Mississauga. As we just heard, one of Axa's classmates pointed his finger at the school and called on guidance counselors to take a more active role in the personal lives of their students. To take a look at how much blame can or should be leveled at the school and the role school counselors play in circumstances like these, The Current contacted Mary Ellen Lang. She's CBC.ca's schooling columnist. She's been a teacher for more than 30 years.
Counselors deal with kids who are in crisis nearly every day, and they deal with great numbers of kids who are in crisis. Sometimes the kids are terrified of a parent or two, and sometimes the parents are terrified of a kid who's really struggling with all kinds of emotional stuff. So they have to report physical abuse if a kid discloses it. You can't go after people before they've committed an offense. And while his daughter was afraid to go home at one point, that's not the basis on which a counselor can really proceed. And counselors also know very, very well that sometimes when you go into a home like that, once the door is shut and the kid's alone with the parents, it's just going to be 10 times worse for the kid, which is also a reason why kids often will tell their friends about these things and they won't tell counselors, because they're afraid that any intervention will only make it worse.
A spokesperson for the Peel District School Board did say that school staff were aware of conflicts within the Parvez family, but no one had any inkling the troubles would lead to violence. According to media reports, Axa's friends also knew about conflicts in her family, including suspicions of abuse. So to take a look at what obligation, if any, Axa's peer group may have had to report this suspected abuse, we contacted Charlotte Murray. She's a lawyer who specializes in family law.
We don't have a generalized Good Samaritan obligation in Ontario to report concerns about someone's safety and welfare. The exception to that comes under the Child and Family Services Act, which is our child protection legislation, and it creates an obligation generally upon the population to report to a Children's Aid Society if there are reasonable grounds to suspect that a child is in need of protection or at risk of sexual, physical, emotional harm. But child is defined in the Act to be a person under the age of 16. I think that we've done a colossally poor job in getting the message out, in part to the population generally, but specifically to students. In a sense, the constituency that's in the best opportunity or best position sometimes to see exactly what is going on in a classmate's life.
Axa's friends at school were under no obligation to report any abuse because she was 16 and technically not a child as defined by the child protection legislation. This week, many media reports have characterized the conflicts within the Parvez family as a clash of cultures between a father who wanted his daughter to wear the traditional Muslim hijab and a teenage daughter who rebelled. That kind of scenario presents a difficult challenge for school counselors because it pits two of their primary goals against each other, ensuring the safety of a student while also being supportive and accepting of the cultures from which they come. Once again, here's Mary Ellen Lang.
There's a line you can't cross, and cultural differences don't get to cross some lines, no matter what they are, how sensitive we are. You're not allowed to beat on your kid, no matter what culture you come from. It's against the law in Canada. So if a counselor is aware that that line has been crossed, they have to report it. If that line has not been crossed and issues in the home or around cultural things, very often a counselor's first impulse is to support the culture and try and help the kid find a way to cope with the cultural demands of the family and still get along in school. If that's counterproductive and it's just going to make the situation worse for the kid, sometimes counselors will try and encourage a child to flee, but that's an extraordinary situation that usually wouldn't happen. We can't solve the world's problems, and Canada is kind of famous, I think, for trying to be warm and fuzzy about all cultures, and we come up with all kinds of programming and values and rationales to include everybody and make everybody's cultural values and religious ideals acceptable, and I wouldn't argue against that, but it shouldn't be a surprise that this happens. Can counselors do anything about it? Not really.
Well, if we accept the limitations of the school and its counselors to intervene in culturally sensitive cases, how much of the responsibility falls on Canada's approach to culture itself, with its warm and fuzzy approach, as Mary Ellen Lang puts it? She's not surprised that lines occasionally get crossed and that a young girl ends up dead. For Tariq Fatah, the founder of the Muslim Canadian Congress, the timidity around criticizing those cultures and the unwillingness to cross any lines ultimately led to Axa Parvez's death.
Oh, it was a complete failure because this young girl had been quite explicit. All her friends knew about that. Supposedly, the teacher or the school principal should have known about that. That political correctness has gone to the degree when nobody wishes to criticize anyone's religious practices. And you know that even after the murder, many of the people have come up and said, instead of denouncing this mixing of religion and culture to oppress women, many of the feminist organizations are coming out and saying that this is common to all religions. And so it actually trivializes the tragedy and steers us away from trying to grasp how serious the matter is when young girls are being forced to wear a headdress.
Well, following this line of Tariq Fatah's argument and the risks of young women being forced to wear hijab, it may be worth taking a closer look at the religious and cultural convictions of Axa Parvez's father, Mohammed Parvez, the man accused of killing her. He's a 57-year-old taxi driver who emigrated from Pakistan. In his new home in Mississauga, he attended the Islamic Propagation Center. The IPCI, as it is known, was founded by Ahmed Didat, a Muslim scholar whose rhetoric has been criticized as fundamentalist. There are plenty of examples of Ahmed Didat's speeches online. Here he is talking about why women should wear a hijab.
The woman who bears her hair, shave it off. That's what the Bible says. But that's your churches, they don't believe all that. And your people don't believe in that. So you are inviting trouble. If Mary, the mother of Jesus, came along, you won't give her a second look. But my dear sisters, those women with bikinis and tangas and G-strings, it's attracting, look, even an old man like me, I tell you.
Well, it's impossible to speculate what, if any, of Ahmed Didat's teachings influence Axa Parvez's father. In many ways, his speeches appear innocuous on the surface. His tone is light, even as he suggests young women who do not wear a hijab may be inviting trouble. But for Tariq Fatah, the hijab is an important symbol, one that can represent a choice and a faith, but under other circumstances also represent oppression. And he says the inability to identify instances where religious convictions are thrust upon the most vulnerable members of minority communities in Canada leaves people such as Axa Parvez vulnerable.
It is extremely unfortunate that none of the feminist groups or women's group in this country have come up to the aid of young women who do not wish to be bracketed and categorized as the frontline troops of the Islamist movement, because don't get me wrong, this is exactly what is happening here, that the Islamist, the clerics and the mosque establishment is using the most vulnerable part of the community, which is young girls, and pushing them to be the flag bearers of their political movement, because this is not about covering your head, this is about making a statement. And unfortunately, those who oppose this have to pay a very heavy price, and Axa Parvez has paid the ultimate price. This is not unique in Pakistan, Egypt, Jordan, Syria. Women are killed simply for offending the authority of the Muslim male head of the family, or for transgressing the authority is supposedly allowed to them under their faith. And it's astonishing that no one seems to be stepping in and saying that this has to end.
Well, faith has many meanings. On the one hand, it's a conviction that something is true or real, such as faith in a just and loving God. Faith can also represent an obligation of fidelity to those very same convictions, obligations which, in the views of some, see those who transgress that faith or certain strict cultural practices to be bringing shame upon the family and even the wider community, and who need then to be severely punished. Some have called it honor killings. But can we really blame radical Islam on what happened to Aksa Parvez? Does Canadian society as a whole have a role in reining in what Tariq Fatah has described as medieval practices of retribution? As Raminder Dosange is quick to remind us, the sort of oppression Aksa Parvez may have faced is common in other communities in Canada. She is a founding member of the India Mahila Association, a volunteer organization for South Asian women.
Some people sometimes find it difficult to integrate quickly, and they live in a world, you know, of their own, not very tied into what's happening around them, and that poses more of a problem as well. But unfortunately, there are pockets in the communities and in our Indo-Canadian community just as well, where they do not integrate properly, and they are very, very strict rules for the women in the community, and we need to take a serious look at that and the conditions that those women are living in.
Well, let's take a moment to describe three cases in Canada where violent circumstances have resembled what some refer to as honor killings. In March of 1991, a man gunned down three people in Calgary with an AK-47. Daljit Singh Dule was found guilty of two counts of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. The court heard he had hired a private investigator to track his sister and her boyfriend as the relationship went against the family's wishes. He'd walked up to a car and fired almost 30 bullets into the young couple. In June of 2000, Canadian 25-year-old Jaswinder Kaur Sidhu was found beaten, her throat slit, in India. Indian police allege her mother and her uncle in British Columbia ordered her death to restore the family's honor. Jazzy, as she was known, had secretly married a poor man from her mother's village, a union that they did not approve of. Her uncle was quoted as saying, "In our culture, this is not acceptable, but we did not kill her." Police in Canada have never filed charges. In July of 2003, Rajinder Singh Atwal took the lifeless body of his 17-year-old daughter to hospital. She had 11 stab wounds. He claimed his daughter, Amadeep, had committed suicide. Prosecutors said Atwal had killed his daughter in a fit of rage because she refused to end a relationship with her white boyfriend. A jury found Rajinder Singh Atwal guilty of second-degree murder. These murders took place not within Canada's Muslim community, but within the Indo-Canadian community. There are those who worry that by pegging culturally specific motivations to a murder, society as a whole may run the risk of absolving itself of responsibility. Uzma Shakir is the executive director of the South Asian Legal Clinic. The way she sees it, Aksa's death is less about religion and more about systemic imbalances that cross all cultural divides.
I mean, there are a million South Asian, close to a million South Asians in GTA. You don't know what, you know, everybody is obviously not going around oppressing and suppressing and killing their children. So you don't know why something like this happens. And I think in the context of the fact that, you know, we are here in the wake of Montreal massacre as well as Picton trial, that we actually view this in the context of gender and you know, power and how men in all societies, in all patriarchal societies, see that they have a carte blanche to control both the actions, the movements of women, and that is, you know, they have the power and therefore they exercise that power to control them, and sometimes it leads to, you know, the ultimate tragedy of killing them.
Aksa Parvez's father was charged with second-degree murder yesterday. According to the law, this means the murder was not premeditated. We are left simply with the case of a 16-year-old daughter and a 57-year-old father accused of killing her. Well, that's all we have for this podcast. You can listen to The Current weekday mornings on CBC Radio 1 right after the 8:30 news, as well as on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. To find out more about our program, visit cbc.ca/thecurrent. If you have any thoughts on what you're hearing on The Current, share them with us. Send us your comments. You can email us at The Current, all one word, thecurrent@cbc.ca. Our mailing address is Post Office Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Or call us collect 1-877-287-7366. To subscribe to other great CBC Radio podcasts, check out cbc.ca/podcasting. Thanks for listening. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.